Hello, everyone. I'm Mani Bakiani, Head of Europe Transport and Hotels Research at Bank of America. I would like to welcome you to Capital Link's Shipping Sector Webinar Series. We will be discussing the latest trends, opportunities, and challenges facing the shipping industry. Today's webinar is on the container shipping market. So today we have with us Evangelos Hatzis, CFO, Danos Corporation, Aristidis Pittas, CEO, Euroseas, Tom Lister, CEO Global Ship Lease, Constantine Back, co-CEO of MPC Container Ships. The opening slide consists of the information for each of the company and the ticker symbol. This webinar will consist of a roundtable discussion with the panelists followed by Q&A. It will last around 45 minutes. Participants can submit questions through the Q&A button on the webinar platform. We'll do our best to answer your questions during the Q&A session. One disclaimer from Capital Link, these webinars are for informational and educational purposes only and do not constitute investment advice or advice of any kind. Also, this webinar will be available as a replay later for those who would like to access it on demand. So with that all out of the way, let's really jump into our discussion. And I think I would like to start this session talking on the demand side of things. So if we look at kind of the global container volumes this year, they're trending up around 6% on a year-on-year basis. So the first question I'd like to put to the panel here is, what do you think has driven this demand growth this year? And where are inventory levels at this point? Evangelos, would you like to start with that?
Yes, thank you. Thank you to Capital Link for hosting this event. And good morning or good afternoon to everyone. So demand indeed is at a very decent number. Of course, if we had this webinar a year ago and I was asked to predict what the overall market would be doing in 24, I would probably have told you that we were expecting a softening in the market, which of course did not come exactly because of the increase in ton miles due to the Suez Canal closure. And this is what has driven the market. The market that has remained as strong as it was last year, this is what it has primarily driven the market this year. We have had several ships that have been delivered. There is a significant order book. Ships continue to be built. But actually, the closure of the Suez Canal was, let's say, the key event that helped the industry maintain its robust profile. In fact, we've seen even speeds go up a bit in an effort of the operators to sort of catch up with schedules and maintain consistent delivery of goods at ports. So it's anyone's guess when the Houthi situation will normalize. I have no crystal ball at our office here to be able to tell you that. But definitely, once if this reverses, we do expect a reversal in the trend of market strength, and market will soften. But that's the main driver of demand this year.
Yes, I mean, if I can add to that, Munib, I agree 100% with everything that Evangelos has said. So ton mile demand has been increased by, you know, roughly 10 or 11% as a result of the diversion around the Cape of Good Hope as a consequence of the Red Sea and Suez being effectively no-go areas for the majority of liner operators. But back to your opening question, underlying fundamental demand has also grown and surprised, I think, certainly us to the upside this year. So not only are containers having to travel further, which adds to synthetic demand, but there's roughly 6% more in terms of container volumes that are actually moving. And it's quite difficult to understand what's driving that. I guess the world economy has strengthened somewhat, at least in comparative terms, this year, with particularly with inflation on a downward trajectory. As to what that's done to inventories, again, that's very difficult to assess, and this is one of the questions we raise actually with investment banking retail analysts periodically, and the feedback we get is that there has been a whipsawing of inventories really ever since COVID. So whether we're on now an accelerated rebuild of inventories again, you know, ahead of uncertainty associated with the new administration coming into the US is a good question, and I don't have a data-driven answer for that, I'm afraid.
And then, Tom, if I may follow up on that point, because that goes into my second question,
Sure.
is, you know, we've kind of, as we think about the President-elect Trump and what he's been talking about in terms of tariffs, how do we think about that impacting container demand next year? And just generally, like, are we looking at a scenario where, you know, the trade multiplier to GDP, which used to be, you know, 2 times 10, 20 years ago, kind of 1 times now, if you were to average it out, like, does it go down even more? How would you think about that?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I mean, I think all of us on this panel think about demand for container ship capacity rather than necessarily demand or volumes of containers per se. Now, that may sound like a perverse point to make, but if we go back to 2018, which is, I guess, the closest, albeit loose, proxy to an escalating, you know, set of trade tensions and the implementation of tariffs, which were obviously at that stage focused on China primarily, what we actually saw was an increase in demand for mid-size and smaller container ship capacity. So, you know, it probably didn't change the volumes of containers moving, but it did change the trade flows. So rather than seeing volumes flowing out of the big mainland Chinese ports of Shanghai and equivalent on the Trans-Pacific, we saw a diversion of trade flows such that the same volumes passed via Southeast Asian manufacturing and finishing locations, so via Vietnam, for example, or Indonesia, for example. And that diversion of volumes actually stimulated demand for mid-size and smaller container ships. So it's very, very difficult to know, first of all, what tariffs will really be put in place. And the devil is always in the detail there. But it's also difficult to anticipate second order effects from those tariffs, and particularly if there are differentials in the tariffs. So we, at least, really don't know. And what we're focusing upon is maximizing the optionality of our fleet, because mid-size and smaller ships can be deployed pretty much anywhere, whereas very big container ships are essentially captive to the big east-west trades. And I think all of us on this panel are focused on mid-size and smaller ships, very operationally flexible assets. So that's one thing, that the pieces can be moved around the chessboard by the liner operators with tremendous flexibility. So that's one benefit. And the other is, you know, making sure that we all have financial flexibility to jump on whatever opportunities may arise when they do arise. As to your question about the trade multiple, I don't know really. I mean, container shipping is now a comparatively mature industry, so it makes sense in some ways that it's linked on more or less a one times basis to GDP growth. Whether it slips below that and then goes marginally above it on an oscillating basis, that's sort of what we've seen over the course of the last few years, with the exception of the sort of the COVID jump in fundamental demand. So sorry, no clear answers to the questions you've raised, but at least there are some sort of directional answers.
In theory, I guess, very short comment. the multiple should not be affected as long as, and I believe this is the case, the majority of the goods that are being transported from China and from Asia to Europe and the US doesn't make any sense for them to be manufactured locally, right? So even if the cost increases a bit, it will always it will continue to make sense that these goods are produced there. So we don't really see the trade flows affected by even a bit of additional tariffs.
If I may add a couple of points here on exact these subjects. I mean, there are two issues in my mind. One is deglobalization going to be happening as a consequence of what Mr. Trump will be doing and the tariffs that he is imposing? This is one question. And of course, if that is going to happen, then the trade multiple, the multiplier can be below 1%. It will be below one, it has been. So in a couple of times, but as Thomas very correctly said, this is a mature business and we would expect us to oscillate around that level. But is the globalization going to happen? Because the second important thing here is that usually all these surprise changes induced by war or regulation or decisions by the politicians have the effect of affecting the markets, the shipping markets positively. Because we love inefficiencies. We love when the best optimum route is not followed anymore and we have to find a suboptimum route to do it. Usually that involves more ton miles, more waiting at port, more. It is very good for our business. And if you look at, you know, even the first tariffs that Mr. Trump suggested, it's 25% on Mexico and Canada. That would imply that less things would flow directly from Mexico and Canada into the United States and maybe need to be transported more, bigger distances from far further away. A good thing for us. So it's extremely difficult to say what will happen. I generally believe strongly that the world depends on the economy and the economy is what makes sense and what moves the world. And I'm quite sure that the US government knows and appreciates that. It might use the fear you know, the suggestion that they will put the huge tariffs and all that stuff to negotiate things. But at the end of the day, I'm quite confident that the economy is what is going to be motivating the final decisions. And there will be some inefficiencies and it won't be that bad for us because as we talked previously, demand and supply seem to be in favor of supply going forward. I mean, there is a big order book. We haven't touched upon that yet, but there is a big order book. Of course, it's spread out over a big period of time. Right, so if you look at the deliveries expected next year, it's just 5%. The year after that, 2026, it's just 3%, and it picks up in 2027 and 2028 with 7% and 8% respectively on those years. So it's spread out quite evenly, and therefore the demand will be the main driver still, even with this order book.
Great, thank you. All very interesting comments here. One other thing that's been coming up a lot in terms of, we talked about disruption, and I was wondering if you want to talk about just port strikes. We saw that come up this September, October around on the US East Coast. There seems to be some agreement on wages, but automation is something that is quite the sticking point in this negotiation. So I know this is kind of more near-term disruption, but any thoughts on how we should be thinking about the ILA dispute and could the workers just break off negotiations? Are we looking at strikes again in January?
Maybe since I haven't had a chance to chip in, maybe I just briefly take that one, although I think it's very difficult to foresee. What is obviously clear that automation is certainly one of the key factors in the current negotiations between ILA and USMX. If you listen at least to the rhetoric of the ILA president, and he at least states that he will not deviate from his course when it comes to the automation issue. So I personally think that, you know, even semi-automation is something that the ILA won't discuss. At least that's what they state. So, I mean, the latest, I think, from mid-November, as far as I'm in the loop there, is that negotiations are, you know, back where they were, and both parties are still unable to find an agreement on automation. And on 15th of January, the deadline is approaching fast. I think we will see how that plays out. I think currently there's obviously only a tentative agreement in place, and I think it will create, in any event, inefficiencies and disruptions. Where that will lead, time will tell. I think it's also a question of the upcoming administration, how they will deal with these kind of issues. They might deal with it differently than the previous, in terms of, you know, taking a clear-cut view and decision maybe. But I think it, in any event, is something that might lead to further disruptions and inefficiencies, if anything. But I think that's at least as far as I would go from where I sit, assessing the situation on the coast in terms of port strikes.
Yeah, and I, you know, I would echo that, and I would amplify what Aristides was saying earlier, which is, if you are a provider of capacity, of tonnage to the liner operators, which all of us on this panel are, any inefficiency, any incremental inefficiency in the system is actually supportive of earnings for people like us. So I fully agree with Constantine that we don't have more visibility on how things are going to play out with the port strikes. But if there is a port strike, counterintuitively, although that's challenging for the liner operators and it's not great news for the consumer, it means more inefficiency and a requirement for more capacity in the system from people like us in order for the liner companies to maintain the same service frequency. So it would be a net upside to earnings.
That's all very clear. Thank you for the insights there. And Aristides started talking about the supply side of things, which is something I'd like to dive a little bit more on. So if you look at the overall kind of global order book to fleet ratio, it's around 25% right now. So it's picked up from the lows we saw of 10% during the pandemic. We've had around 10% addition to the fleet already this year. Kind of anyone a bit worried about this order book? Can this really be absorbed by the market? And could it go more than 25%? Are there more orders coming?
Well, shall I conclude that?
Please go ahead.
Okay. 25% is definitely a big order book, but as I said previously, it's spread over 5 years, and there is no capacity to build ships and deliver them even in 2027 anymore. We're talking about 2028 almost, and even 28 is getting quite full. So it's a very spread order book, and the bottom line will depend a lot on how demand goes, because an order book of 5% per year is not huge. And if we see some poorer market, which leads to a lot of scrapping, which will be needed at some point, that will obviously rebalance the market quite soon. So I think there is this possibility of a rebalancing of the market if the market drops quite quickly. One more thing about the order book is that it's concentrated on the bigger ships. And for all of us here that are, you know, ships up to maximum 9,000 TEU, let's say, ourselves, we are even lower than 6,000 TEU. There, the order book is extremely small. It's less than 10%. So we're talking about a very small order book in the sectors that we are involved. And with all these disruptions happening, smaller ships are even more and more needed. So I'm quite positive about this size range.
Maybe one, I agree with everything Aristides said generally, maybe a few additions that I think are relevant as well. And firstly, what we also see is next to the order book stretching out and ongoing disruptions and inefficiencies, we touched on a few just now, is that liner companies, in anticipation of inefficiency and disruptions, and in order to be able to service their customers, provide for slack in the system. Meaning, you know, they rather keep more vessels on charter than they did in the past. And that is also a big differentiation factor between logistical shipping, i.e. container shipping, and commodity shipping being dry bulk and tankers, where simply people want to maintain their bus lane, so to say, bus lane service from A to B, and need to ensure that they can service their customers, because especially if disruptions occur, they can also earn the extra dollar by providing their services, and they want to maintain a clear service offering. And you can see that in the fleet strategy of all the big liner companies. So that's one point. Another point is the replacement need. And Aristides alluded to some of the aspects, but if you look at the smaller sector, almost 1,000 vessels are above 20 years of age. I think it's 890 is the number. So there is a significant replacement need in a sector where we haven't seen a lot of ordering. So in my book, at least, you know, we see the big liner companies trickling down from ordering the very large ships. Now, just recently, Hapag and Maersk ordered 9,000s. Smaller vessels will come in any event. And I'm not concerned about that because that's desperately needed. And lastly, and not least, is the and we have, as a company, for example, we have undertaken more than 20 retrofit dockings, which means vessels go out of the water, are in dock for longer. If you look at the age profile of the vessels, a 20-year docking in terms of steelwork takes longer. So you also have an inactive capacity that is more and more, and that also has an impact on the supply side. So also a very relevant factor. And last but certainly not least, the Red Sea situation. That's obviously, that would be a negative to the supply side, to make that point as well, because if that was resolved, we would definitely be in a different situation. And then out of a sudden, there might be overcapacity. But as far as, you know, from where I sit today, I don't have the answer, and I certainly don't have a view because of the complexity in the region. But I know that all the liner companies' base case is 2025, the Red Sea will be closed. So I think that adds to the picture and maybe gives some additional color in addition to what Aristides has said.
And I would like to add to Constantine's prior point about liners wanting to secure tonnage, because that affects our particular situation as owners, operators. We have, for example, placed orders for 20 container ships. We have already taken delivery of 6 this year. We have 14 more to go. We have fixed all of them for 5 years. We're talking about fixtures for vessels that will deliver in 27 and 28. We have managed to fix all of them at terrific rates, at today's strong rates, for 5 year periods. So, speaking about demand, supply, and what have you, is one thing, and where the charter rates are going to go. But if you manage in today's market, and I believe more or less we've all been able to secure good length charters at very decent rates, you know where you're going to be over the next 2 or 3 years, and you will be in a position to weather not the storm, but the softer market through charter coverage. I mean, ourselves, we're north of 95% covered for next year and close to 80% for the year after. So to a certain extent, discussion about the spot market is not much relevant when you have such charter coverage for the coming years.
Yes, and maybe to add to that, sorry, Muniba, go on.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say that, and I think this was a point made either by Evangelos or Aristides earlier, as a result of the diversion around the Cape of Good Hope due to the closure of the Suez Canal and the Red Sea, the global container ship fleet has sped up. So, you know, because the starting point was already very limited slack in the system, limited idle capacity in the system, the only way to accommodate these longer voyage distances was by speeding up. Now, no one likes speeding up their container ships because it means burning a lot more fuel to go further. And burning a lot more fuel means greater emissions. And as emissions measures like EU ETS and, you know, ever-evolving emissions penalties start kicking in, there is a growing pressure, really, economic pressure on the lines themselves, who have to pass these costs ultimately through to the consumer, to the cargo interests, to slow down in order to reduce emissions, in order to reduce the cost of moving cargo from A to B. So despite the fact that there is a large order book, which, as all of the guys have said, is bifurcated into the really big ships, which we're not really competing against, and then the mid-size and smaller ships, which have an order book to fleet ratio of roughly 10% delivering over the course of the next few years. In addition to that, there will be, as slack appears in the system, an incentive for the lines to start slowing down the tonnage to reduce fuel burn and emissions. So I think that's another potential mitigating factor going forward.
That's a great point, Tom. And that kind of brings us to this whole topic around sustainability in the industry. And we've seen kind of more orders overall for the fleet coming through using LNG. Maersk has been talking a lot on biofuels. So kind of in your view, what do you think is the future for green shipping? What's the future fuel here?
I don't know. I mean, Evangelos and Aristides have placed orders for new tonnage, so they'll have a more refined view than I, and also Konstantin. At the moment, we at least are hedging our bets, waiting to see, and where available using biofuel, which can be burnt in, you know, alongside conventional fuels within our existing ships. But beyond that, I guess the other guys may have a clearer view on this than I.
Not really, Tom. We don't have a clearer view. And the ships that we've ordered, we had an order for 9 vessels. We've taken delivery of the 7. We're taking the last 2 in January. And then we placed another order for 2 more ships that we'll get in 2027. All these, we're just doing the very simple stuff of being LNG ready, which is just providing the space to be able to transform the vessel into an LNG vessel, if that becomes what the solution, or at least the solution for the next 5 to 10 years. But other than that, we're not taking any position. Of course, we are doing what most prudent ship owners are doing in all the sectors. We are trying to use digitalization and other means, make modifications to the ships so that we improve the efficiency, so we make our ships as efficient as possible. But we're not taking a bet on any fuel. And if we're honest, I don't think anybody's taking such a bet. The very big liner companies, they maybe are committing, you know, 1% of their resources into trying to see to and ordering a few methanol ships here and there, or looking at other solutions, but it's only experimental at this stage, and we don't really know the solution. We don't know which fuel will prevail, and I believe quite firmly that we will continue to be using existing fuel, blended as it may be. Because that is already happening, and we have fuels consisting with 30% biofuel and all that stuff. So all this will be in play, but I really don't know what where we will arrive at, it won't be so fast. That's our belief here. LNG is the interim, but you have carbon capture, you have nuclear, you have wind, you have everything, hydrogen, ammonia. I think it's a huge bet to take if somebody wants to go one way. And we are not prepared, and I think nobody's really doing it.
Maybe just from my side, and I agree. Whoever knows the answer will be a rich man or a rich woman. So I think no one knows the answer at this stage. Having said that, I mean, we at least, you know, you have to, if you're an owner, you at least need to take a decision. You either sit on the sideline or you take a position. So overall, we at least remain fuel agnostic and believe at the end, you know, that there is fuel availability is an issue. That's one point. And that's why, you know, LNG, biofuel are the obvious solutions at the moment to at least do something. We, for example, have also ordered dual fuel methanol vessels, which we will take delivery in a few weeks' time. And we do this because we think as an owner, you need to get some exposure. And exposure not just means reading about it, but means take a position. But always do that on a risk-adjusted basis, because we have teamed up with someone, with a charterer, with the freight side of things, and we have a 15-year contract. So we are kind of jointly de-risking that investment and get exposure to a new fuel. And I think that's the way at least we think is we should be doing this. So fuel availability is one thing. Collaboration and de-risking is another thing. And very importantly, I think, and that should be raised by the whole industry, in absence of clear guidelines and efficient markets, you know, it's super difficult for anyone, and one cannot expect anyone to take significant investments unless there's a level playing field and people know what to do. We are, for example, you know, we put our, not our bets, but our, we take our exposure to get to know certain technologies. We are also partnering up with the Mercer McKinney Center of Zero Carbon Shipping, and we follow all the technologies. Having said that, you know, price competitiveness, availability of fuels, and safety concerns are still the three, in my view, main areas why people currently are tending back to LNG, a proven technology, and biofuels. And I think no one can blame anyone not to take a bigger position, because it's simply risky, at least for smaller companies like us, and maybe also some of my fellow panelists here, who don't have a $1 billion in R&D expense in the pocket, right? So it's really doing the right thing, getting exposure, and that's the way we approach this, being very fuel agnostic at the same time.
Yeah, and I think picking up on a couple of those points, we also, as providers of capacity to the space, we don't control where our ships are operated, which means we can't determine the bunker infrastructure or the fuel provision infrastructure that they're going to be exposed to. All of that is under the control of the liner operators, which is why, although, you know, maybe as Aristides was saying, the investments that each of the lines have done are, in comparative terms to their whole operated fleet, comparatively modest, they can at least control those critical variables. They can take a view on a fuel. They can make an offtake agreement with the energy provider, and they can control where the vessel is traded to ensure that that vessel has access to the fuel for its economic lifetime. None of those things are within our control. And I think crucially, this explains why the principal investment into container ships has been flowing into the bigger ships, hence the order book weighted to the really big ships, by which I mean sort of 10,000 TEU and up, and actually, frankly, 13,000 TEU and up, because it's the liner companies who are taking a view on these experiments with new propulsion technologies, whereas the guys in the liquid charter market, which is where all of us on this panel today compete, have been taking either a wait and see approach, which is our approach, in other words, retrofitting existing ships, doing what we can with existing ships to make them more efficient until we get a clearer view of what's going on, or taking a measured approach like, you know, Konstantin laid out, where, you know, getting a textured understanding of a selected fuel in a very controlled way to form a view as to whether or not that's going to be the future. But the long and the short of this is, limited investment has been flowing into the ships for our sizes, which means that the economic lifetime of those ships are being extended, which means the peer group is aging, which means that in due course, there will have to be, you know, a very active investment in the space to renew that tonnage. But in the meantime, all of this is very, very helpful to the supply side dynamics for us.
That's all very clear. And in terms of regulation, where do you see that going? Evangelos, any thoughts on just environmental regulations?
It's, look, with Trump, with the Trump re-election, it's anyone's guess. I mean, we all saw what happened in Azerbaijan a few weeks ago, a couple of weeks ago, actually. It's been long expected that the IMO will put in place a global tax, which actually the pooling of the cash coming from this tax is supposed to be reinvested in the production or the subsidy of green fuels and what have you, which will sort of, to a big extent, drive the decarbonization process. I'm not exactly sure at what pace this will proceed, given US's intention to pull out from the Paris Accord and what have you. So I don't think that anyone, at least we cannot sort of give people a timeline as to how regulation will develop. What is definitely the case is that Aristides, I think, mentioned that it's going to move slower than people expect it to. Because even if all this starts happening, people have to appreciate that, you know, shipbuilding capacity, in order to build the ships that will burn green methanol or whatever other fuel is out there, is not unlimited. So this is going to take a number of years to replace the outgoing, more, let's say, carbon inefficient fleet. I don't really see this in the next, let's say, 5 years at least, to play a big role in the demand supply equation.
But Muniba, if I may add, I think regulation, of course, is extremely important. It is what really forces everybody to respond to. So how fast things develop, of course, will depend on regulation. The IMO generally is aggressive, but not as aggressive as some governments are. The governments are more aggressive because it's easier to be political about it and, you know, talk to all the people in your country and say we're taking measures for the environment. The IMO is doing it, I think, as well as it can, taking into consideration the technical limitations and the economic conditions, but of course is dragged into taking decisions as well. But really, this is the framework which we will all have to agree and follow. The hope is that we will all follow what the IMO says, and we have a level playing field. What the EU did, which is running a little bit ahead of the IMO in the strictness of its obligations, it's really okay. I mean, I don't have a serious problem with that, because it applies equally to shipping from wherever it is provided. So even the Asian companies, if they come to Europe, they have to pay with their ships. So if that is done and done properly, the level playing field is not harmed. What is harmed is the competitiveness of the European citizen, because he ends up paying a little bit more, because, you know, we transfer the cost to the charter to the cargo providers, the cargo providers eventually to the ordinary man. So, but this is a cost that, you know, Europe is prepared to take. It's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. It's the answer to your question is going to vary by geography, I think, Muniba. And certainly we're not detecting any slowing down yet in the pace of implementation of these anti-emission regulations by the European Union. In fact, there's a new regulation that comes into effect starting January 1st of 2025, which is Fuel EU Maritime, which once again is going to make it more expensive to emit within EU waters. But as Aristides says, this is at least a level playing field, because it applies to anyone who's operating a ship into and out of and within European waters. Whether there'll be a corresponding slowdown in measures in other geographies, like the US as an obvious example, remains to be seen. But the EU at least seems to be continues to be forging ahead.
Thank you. I look at the airline space as well, and we've seen kind of similarly there, where the EU has been well ahead of other geographies in implementing regulation, and kind of global regulators haven't really been able to enforce, even though the airline industry started this journey. Well, if you go back to the UETS in 2012, so we're more than 10 years later and still waiting for a global solution. So we'll probably be talking about this for a while. But if I may switch gears, we've talked about politics quite a bit. We've talked about Red Sea in our discussions, and you know, it's hard to say how the geopolitics will turn out, and when does the Red Sea kind of reopen the Suez. But in the scenario the geopolitics are sorted out, kind of what is really needed to get the liners to resume a voyage through the Suez? You know, as from your perspective, who is deciding here and what's needed?
Maybe I kick it off, and because we I mean, what liners decide is their decision. I can just say what we will do and what we have not done since the issue, you know, started basically almost a year ago. For us, it's 100% clear: safety and well-being of the crew and seafarers is of utmost importance. We have actually stopped. We have even had fights with some of the liner operators because we were actually meant to go through according to the charter party, but we have said we will not do it because that is an overruling and overarching principle of ours. And I think actually most of the liner operators will say the same, that, you know, you cannot compromise on safety, well-being and the life of your seafarers. And that's, I think, as long as there is a complete uncertainty around Houthis attacks, I think it's very difficult, and I think resolving the issue there. And I'm not an expert, of course, on the geopolitical scene. But everything that I see, I think there's clearly one issue, and there's not one person in charge. So even for the new upcoming administration in the US, they cannot just go there, strike a deal. It's a way more complex situation. So striking a deal to find peace and have the vessels go through the Red Sea in peace, I think this is a super difficult answer. And at least as far as I'm concerned, from all the data points and everything that I see, and also talking to our customers, the liner operators, the base case is not a transit through the Red Sea in 2025 and maybe beyond. So I think that speaks for itself. And I think everyone is placing safety and well-being of crews on the top of the priorities, and that's where we are. So I think as soon as is a safe, and the question is who decides what is safe, I think there will be transits again, more transits again. There are obviously some people who take that decision, but I think normality will only come once it's really safe to go through again, and the stars need to be aligned to see that actually happening, in my view, in the near term.
Muniba, if I may add to what Constantine said, Clarkson's, you know, we all know, is, you know, one of the biggest shipping research firms and broker around. And up till 3 or 4 months ago, they were running their forecasts, assuming that in 2025, at some point, we would see a return to normality. Now, their main forecast is saying what Constantine just said, for sure 2025 and 2026, we will not be back to normality. So that's coming from, you know, the biggest shipping broker and research firm. It's very difficult to say what will happen. Things are getting worse instead of better. I just heard that the Southern Korean government applied martial law in Southern Korea. I don't know what that means, but that's not nice. We hear and we fear that the French government will not be able to hold. So all these geopolitics, they seem to be getting worse rather than better. So the environment is indeed, you know, totally difficult to predict. And that's why most of the shipping companies, certainly all of those which I follow, which are here in the panel, have taken great lengths to strengthen their balance sheet and be as safe and be able to navigate anything, you know, any difficulty that we may have. But on the other hand, you know, things might continue to be good as they have been up to now.
Yes, and I think there's another thing. You know, if you're in the bulker or the tanker space and the Red Sea suddenly reopens and Suez reopens, it's much, much easier to redirect your vessels that way for parcels of cargo. However, there's a huge amount of network inertia for the liner companies because they're running, I think, Constantine used the analogy of this bus service. And it's not just a bus service, it's a very complicated bus service with hubs and spokes and interlocking networks and pre-booked slots at terminals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I would suspect that even if there were to be a dramatic improvement geopolitically, which permitted Suez and the Red Sea to reopen, it would probably be the liner operators who would be the last of the sectors to actually take that up. Because if they redesign their networks to assume that the Red Sea and Suez is going to remain open, then it's going to take them a hell of a lot of work and cost to revert back to going around the Cape of Good Hope. So I think network inertia will also sort of slow the adoption of the Red Sea and Suez for the liner operators, our customers.
So people do not generally believe that Donald Trump can bring world peace within 24 hours as he had promised, I guess.
Yes, many.
Never say never, Evangelos.
Many questions here is quite clear from all the comments from the political side, as well as then what would be needed after that. I do realize the time and we've past the 45 minute mark. So just wanted to see if there are any questions from the audience. Please do feel free to send them through the button on your platform, and I'd happily take them. But while we wait, maybe just one question, as we've talked about this bus service, some of that is changing around with the new alliances coming through. So does that change anything from your perspective?
I think it changes. Okay, so we're talking specifically, I guess, about the Gemini Alliance, which is the Hapag-Lloyd and Maersk Alliance, which is a sort of a genuinely reshaped alliance and service structure, which is much more, I suppose, analogous to the aviation model of hub and spokes. And what we are seeing and what we expect to continue seeing is, as a result of that hub and spoke model, a heightened demand for mid-size and smaller ships to service the spokes. So again, from our perspective, our collective perspective as tonnage providers of mid-size and smaller container ships, I think it's a positive development.
Maybe just to add to that, I think in general, new alliances can also easily be overstated, the impact of it, because, I mean, it doesn't change the number of market participants, neither on the demand or supply side to start with. Having said that, it obviously gets interesting when you look at network designs, as Tom has pointed out. So I think this is where it gets interesting. And if you look at some of the, let's say, I wouldn't say innovations, but new strategies that Maersk has implemented, be it pioneering, getting larger and larger on the ship sizes, be it the first operator to send ultra-large container ships into the Baltic Sea. I mean, there have been a few things that have really had an impact on the market. And what I would say is that we might gain efficiencies on, you know, the new alliance, in particular, as they now, you know, Hapag and Maersk, they operate on operated or owned terminals, which gives them preference. So there might be efficiency gain on the hub and spoke. However, that should not dilute Tom's statement earlier, because I still think, you know, the boxes still need to be carried on from there by mid-size and smaller ships. And secondly, obviously, they have taken out a few direct port calls again, which means you need to transship, you need more feedering. So I think there will be, the reliability might go up and will probably and likely go up on the system itself. But the onward voyage and the onward transshipment and transportation of the boxes, that obviously follows different reliability criteria and different is exposed to different disruption elements. So I think I do believe there will be more efficiency, and there will be something to gain for the shippers as the customers of the Gemini Alliance parties. But there are also, let's say, intricacies to it, as far as, you know, last mile and shuttle services, et cetera, is concerned. And we obviously watch that very closely for as this is two of our key customers. And we are definitely there to assist in terms of providing additional assets that serve the last mile, so to say.
So the bottom line here is that, you know, whilst there is a change in the alliances, we still practically have four alliances with MSC going on its own. But the big change is what they discussed about the hub and spoke principle, which might benefit the smaller vessels.
That's all very clear. I think in the interest of time, I will wrap up here. And thank you so much for sharing all your insights and joining us today. And for all the panelists for joining us as well this afternoon. So have a great day, everyone.
Thank you very much.
You too. Thank you very much.